Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.
This is how I'm starting the episode now. It's just you swearing.
Oh, right. I forgot we were recording.
Hey, Clayton. How you doing?
Pretty sweet, Benny. How about you?
Oh, pretty good. Hey, I see you got a new hat. And the reason I can see you got a new hat is because we're still doing a video podcast. And that also means you can see that I'm no longer wearing giant headphones. I got these AirPods. So I've joined the year 2020 and I'm real excited about it. You know what else I'm excited about is our conversation that we had today with Sasha from Kova. It was a real treat. And I say that because it's a prime example of something that that I kind of love, which is the idea of get in where you fit in. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to fitting in where you get in, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a really profound little quip there, actually. But what's beautiful about, I think, this conversation is that, you know, we really get an insight into a person's journey of applying for work, meeting a company, being intrigued, big corporate bullshit meter ready to detect where the weaknesses are. And she just really unpacks that process for her. And then the experience of working here in the honeymoon phase and her career progression in the time that she's been here. And I think it's a very human story. I think it's one that illustrates some of the challenges and the opportunities of working here. And just, it was really nice. It was a conversation that really energized me and I really enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation as well. I feel like I say that all the time, but I do really mean it. There's a reason why we do this podcast, and conversations like this really exemplify that. So it was a great chance to get to know someone a little bit better. I do work occasionally in the same office as Sasha, but it was nice to just sit down and have a dedicated conversation with her and learn more about her and how she sees the world. But I don't want to give it all away. And I'm sure you don't either. So we'll listen to the episode. And if you like, you can listen to the end and then Clayton and I will be there talking about stuff again. So maybe we'll see you then.
Maybe. Oh, wow. Just a gamer here. Just ready to roll. Are you a gamer? You got gamer headphones.
I am a gamer.
Okay. Yeah. That's what we're going to talk about then. Okay.
Sure.
That's where we're going to start, because I am a gamer too, but because I'm a grandpa gamer, I bet you we have different perspectives on the how, what, and why of gaming, and why it's useful, and how we spend our time, and why we spend our time that way. So that'll be where we start. If it's total bullshit, we'll just clap. That tells Benny to edit that all out, and then we'll start over.
I mean, you don't have to clap. I listen to the whole thing. And before you start, I just want to say, I appreciate that you're a gamer because it means that you brought a really good headset and microphone to the recording. So you nailed the takeoff. So let's see where we go. Yeah.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. We call it Unpacking Chrysalis, the Art of Being Human. Not because we figured out the art of being human, but because we're just trying to make space to figure it out together. So we have this podcast as a way to get to know some of the really interesting, fascinating, and wonderful people that work with us, to see what gives them energy, have a better sense of what their worldview is, and we just talk about random things. So, today we've got Sasha on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Sasha. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Sweet. Yeah, I'm doing really well, actually. Pretty jazzed. I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you. You know, why don't you share a little bit about what kind of work you do here?
I work for Kova, and I am a team lead of a development team that does all things related to traceability. So all the state integrations and reporting systems that we need to report illegal cannabis sales to, this is our domain of knowledge, plus a few bits and pieces on the side.
Yeah, that sounds mysterious. Maybe we'll get into that later, but okay, so that's what you do. How did you find us as a company to work for, and how long have you been around?
I found you through the recruiter. Like, Chrysalis was coming up, I think, a couple of times when I was searching. I was just never sure what the company is about. Or IQ Metrics, actually, more specifically. And point of sale just sounded very generic, but then when I was looking for a job and my recruiter was just sending me the options that they had, and Kova was one of the better ones, you know. In that round of interviews, actually, Kova stood out a lot from all the other companies, because quite quickly I realized that those two or three other companies that I interviewed with did the initial round. You just sit there and you look at these people and you know they don't want you and you know you don't want to be with them. It's just, they're nice people. They're nice people. They just have nothing. Like, there was no spark, you know. It was interesting. And then with Kova, there was a spark, you know, from the person who did the first round of interviews with me, just to introduce the whole concept of the company and what we do here and how we do it. And that was really way more exciting than everything else.
Yeah. Do they do, you still have to do a cultural interview with Kova?
Yeah. And it was Andy, I believe, who was doing it.
Andy?
Yeah.
No.
So it was lovely. It was just, you know, he has such a great personality. It was really great to talk to him.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, that cultural interview was quite fascinating. It's quite, you know, cultural interviews for us is an attempt to be very aware. Do we think this person that we're going to offer this job to will thrive here? Like, will they add to the experience that we're having here, right? We really just value the human being as a human being. And so we really try in those cultural interviews to really understand, do we think our environment is right for this person? But I'll tell you another thing that we really try to accomplish in these cultural interviews is I always want to inform the other person with such clarity about what we think is special about us that when they get the job offer, they'll be able to say to themselves, do I want to work in a place like that? And if they do, great. But also if they don't, great. Because it saves them, you know, maybe a year, two, 3 years of kind of frustration and irritation. And so that's why I try to be really transparent in those cultural interviews.
I mean, this is what you kind of expect from the cultural interview, right? But so many times it turns out that people just fake it for you on the cultural interview and they just tell the script and then you start working and it's just the same old, we're just gonna, you know, bring you.
Oh, on the company side, the companies are BSing you? Oh.
Yeah, so like what? You go through the interview levels and people tell you the story as if it's just something really great and they're trying really to sell the company to you, the environment, the culture, and then you join and it's just a similar, you know, 9-to-5, micromanagement, everything else that you really love about the companies,
right.
Corporate bullshit, you know, and it's all just there, and they just say, well, everyone says these great things and this is what they turn out to be in reality, so we also say these great things about ourselves. And it's like a bit of like, you know, like dating. Yes, the other person.
Right.
Into believing you better than you are.
right.
I like that we do our cultural ad interviews first before we do the technical interview, which I think is great, right? Because if you do it the other way, you kind of could make an excuse. If the person's really technically savvy,
totally.
You could like check that box. Hey, here's a question though. How well did the cultural interview you do align with the experience that you're having now?
Well, that's the thing. This one was, I think, the first one where actually just aligned. Like, it wasn't just a wishful thinking and, you know, listening to all this and then coming to work with the company and just seeing how redacted it was, you know, from the real deal. And this one turned to be very close to reality. Like, people were genuinely excited to see me and work with me. And, you know, there was not, you kind of, when you come to work at a new company, even though people who are usually doing the meet and greet round with you, your manager, HR, they would be mostly doing it as, you know, just they would try to be happy and energized and try to pass on the good vibes to you, but then you look around, you see the dead eyes, you see the dead spaces, you see all these like hallmarks of like company that is just, you know, going through the usual pathway of it. And then in Kova, even, you know, with a huge office that is almost empty, there was way more energy than at the any other company that I walked through or worked at. It was just more genuine. Like, people were actually kind of excited about what they're doing. They're generally happy with how they're doing in the company. So that was great. Like, that was a huge change. Like, I still think this is like, you tend to have a honeymoon phase with the company. Everything's new. You're excited. You're like, this is brand new stuff. I'm going to learn so much. I'm going to achieve so much. And then, you know, reality sits in. But in this case, I think like I'm still slowly going off my honeymoon phase. Like, it's still okay. It's still there. Like, I'm still excited about the company in a way that I wasn't before.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, I've been here for 27 years, which I know is weird, but you know, when I'm having a really bad time, I have to remind myself, at its worst, this is just a really good job, actually. Yeah. When it gets really bad.
There's really it's good like, people, too.
There's good people. It's a good job. I'm asked to contribute to, like, my domain. Like I'm given, you know, the flexibility to have agency within my domain. Like, what's my responsibilities? I have a lot of autonomy there. Of course, you know, I have to get in sync with my teammates and make sure that what I'm doing aligns with what the company's trying to do. I don't want to be a free-range chicken, but it is wild how that is an interesting pattern. Like, even at the worst, I've even said to people, I have to say, I say this in a conversation, if this job was available to apply for, I would apply for it and hope that I got it. Right? Even when I'm having a really bad day or a bad time, it's still a wonderful job for a lot of reasons. But anyway, I think that when you said that honeymoon for you is extended, that really struck for me too. But yeah, that's nice. That's your experience. What did you notice about the gap between what was on offer, what you thought this place might be, and what it actually was? What were the gaps and kind of what contributed to those gaps?
I actually don't remember much because the way my brain works, I actually don't really tend to remember the details much. And for the interview process, for the hiring process, it's usually going in such a weird pace too, where my previous contract was not extended. I was pretty happy to be done with that place because it clearly just didn't really match what I was looking for. And so I just said to myself, you know what, I'm just going to have a month of like not working. I can afford to do that. I just need a break because, you know, my partner was the witness to my demise, basically. Every day I would just come and I would just like flop down on the sofa face down and just say how much I hate the whole thing.
Right.
I think I was depressed, basically.
Yeah.
That job made me miserable, and it was such a traumatic experience, I guess, in some ways, that I was like, I need a break. And maybe a week or two in, my recruiter reached out because she placed me at the previous place too, and so she's like, oh, I heard you're looking for a job, let's try and find you something. And I was like, oh, that's 2 weeks in, you know, I mean, it's going to probably go slow. And then it just starts happening really fast. Like, you have like interview after interview, like every other day, and you have to review a lot of stuff. So when offers start coming, you don't really get the full details, because this is also a reality of having an agent represent you, because you don't really get the full deal. You get a very filtered, redacted version from them. And even though my recruiter was really great, I'm not a big fan of this whole process, because so many things are just unsaid, or salary negotiations are actually my pet peeve with this, because they tell you what the company would expect you to say. But the implication is that you have to bend down to the company level in a way, right? So this is something that, like, I'm not a great negotiator. I'm trying to become better. I'm trying to stand my boundaries and do my things, but that was a bit tricky. Yeah. But yeah, luckily for me, like, that wasn't there wasn't a big gap in like salary negotiations and stuff. That was great. And I think the main sort of the main summary of this whole process was that there were no like huge gaps. right? So people who I talk to, Andy on the cultural interview, Mike and Gabe on the technical interview, it was so funny that, you know, we started talking and it's just the usual, like, hey, you know, what's your experience? Just tell us a little bit. And you tell them a little bit. And then they're like, oh, here, we have this little code solution here. Would you like to take a look? Would you like to, you know, start discussing what you see? And I was like, okay, okay, that's cool, that's cool, that's standard. And, oh, that's something new. And they're like, yeah, this is what we do. This is our own way of dealing with things. And then I just started, like, asking a bunch of questions. And in my mind, the interview still didn't start. Like, I'm still learning, you know. In my mind, I'm just still here. And then I look at the time, and it's been 45 minutes out of our hour. And I ask them, hey, wait, I have to write some code, right? And they're like, you passed the interview 20 minutes ago. We're just chatting with you because it's cool. And I was like,
yeah,
this is not how it's supposed to go, you know.
Yeah.
Like, how do you pass a technical interview without, like, writing any code?
Right.
And they're like, no, no, you ask the right questions. Not a lot of people actually start asking questions. And I was like, okay. Yeah. So, you know, in a way, it was just like a bit of a dreamy sequence where you just, like, you just do something, you just have a chat, and then turns out that was your hiring process and you passed
right.
it.
Like, turns out I got a job offer coming.
Turns out, yeah, you got a job offer. And this is also what was interesting. They just told me right away, like, look, we don't have everything 100% set up yet, but we're just telling you right now so you don't get worried too much. We want you here. We will be, you know, trying to push the process forward. So that was really, you know, it was different, and it felt like people genuinely wanted to find someone who would be a match for the team, match for the company, and they were excited to have me there. So that was a really great feeling. And, you know, it didn't change. It wasn't like I joined the team and I was abandoned. It
continued. Right. Here's your checklist. Get all this stuff done. We'll talk to you on Tuesday. Yeah, there's a continuity of the vibe, the relationship, the importance of a human, right? I always think about it as I feel welcome here, which is a little bit different than belonging at a, or, you know, I don't know. I don't know how I should describe it, but I always think the more a person feels welcome here, like they belong here, we want to hear from them, we want to engage with them, we want to have them be part of what we're doing. That is the part that to me is kind of special. And you know, we're not a perfect company. It's a hard place to work, and there's a lot of challenges that it asks a lot of you, of course, but I feel like somewhere in there is the difference, where we do actually live out that human side as a real thing and not just a slogan. Yeah, people matter. But there's something different about it. Do you sense that, or do you experience that little bit of difference in the intention of it all?
I think I do. And for me, I think it was the easiest way to tell, like the most prominent sign, I would say, right, was that usually when you come to the office, you have your work persona. Right.
Yeah.
Because you have to adapt yourself, right? You have to match. You have to mask. You have to fit what's there. And I think coming to Kova and seeing just people, just they're all different, and it's all great. You know, like of course we do some self-filtering. Of course you would not be as open with like colleagues as friends, right, or family. But there was way less that I felt I needed to do. I felt there was no need for me to match expectations or to match some specific vibe because it was like, hey, you're just a new person and we're just happy to have you and we're happy to see who you are. Not like we're not happy to see you fit the narrative, you know, the structure, the boxes.
What effect do you think that has on people coming into an environment like that? What does that do? Maybe for you, but or maybe just for other people. What does that do?
I feel like it just frees you in a way. It just gives you more freedom. Like, your decisions would not be based off of what people expect of you to say or to do, right? You just feel more free to make decisions, and that gives you... I feel, for me, it was definitely that it gave me more confidence, you know? And I think it was also interesting that I joined, and in about 6 weeks, I was offered a position of team lead, which I was never a team lead before. I was never in any sort of leading position. And when I asked why, I was just given an answer, because we think you'll be great at it. And I will be great at it? That's something that I never tried. Like, yeah, we think you will be great at it. And I'm like, okay. I guess, like, the worst that can happen is that I tank all the expectations and they just get demoted down, which is not a loss. I like what I'm doing here, right? And so I was like, okay, let's try it. And that was a really wild ride for me, because, you know, this is not how things happen. This is not how they're supposed to happen.
But the trust in the environment, the trust that you had in the environment, made that seem like, okay, I'll be courageous and I'll try it. I trust you folks.
Yeah, the most important part for me was also, it's not just, hey, this is your new title and your new responsibilities and just go and deal with it. This is more like, hey, we will support you. It is our best interest to make sure you succeed. It is in our best interest, so we will try to do everything we can do to help you on this journey, to help you learn, to help you become a better lead, or a lead even, because
right.
It was better than zero, anything right. Really at that point. So it was a great journey, and I think this was done in a really good way, right? It's not done in a way like, hey, the other person who was taking this post just got... we got rid of them and this is your post now because we have no one better, and just go and deal with it, right? It was a very intentional change. Yeah, it was an intentional change. It's like, hey, we need to split the teams, we have a big team, we need to split a bit because it's becoming like counterproductive for us to be organized in such a manner. So it was really interesting, like how it was done and how it was very supportive, like the whole process felt really supportive.
Have you been through experiences like that, team splitting, for example, in other companies?
No, it was usually quite static. Yeah, I was in a weird way moved between teams, but it never really felt like it was actually happening, because I was factually working with the same team. Nominally, my manager was different. I just never really tended to work on his project. I worked with other teams, so it was just at some point they might did. Like, the closest to that was maybe just when I got moved from developer in QA to full developer in the first company I was hired at. But then again, it's still same people you deal with. It's just slightly different context.
If you were to think about leadership, like your transition into developing into a lead, what did you find more enjoyable or rewarding about it than you expected? What gave you energy that you didn't realize might give you energy?
I think for me, the biggest part of it is that I get more opportunity and more power, maybe for the lack of a better word, to help people, to directly help my team, right? This is where I can shield from unnecessary things, and I can try and work out on a strategy of maybe communicating with other teams or working with other teams that benefits us more, right? This was important for me. And the part that was unexpected, I think, was that you're suddenly in a position to help a lot of people on their journey. Because it's a bit of a different dynamic when it's just your teammate that you're looking up to, and then suddenly it's your team lead. Because no matter how we try to make it even, like, I don't really care for the title itself, right? I just care for the opportunities I have in this position. But the dynamics are slightly different, right? When you become someone's lead versus when you just work side by side.
Oh yeah, it's subtle, like, but significant.
With great power comes great responsibility. You're suddenly in that area where, like, you have to watch a bit better what you say and how you say it. But you also are given that opportunity to help someone in direct ways, to become just a better version of themselves in some way, you know?
Yeah. It's a real transition, though. I remember when I first moved into leadership roles, I joke around a lot with people and I have a lot of fun with my colleagues. What I didn't realize is that when you know, what yesterday was just a funny joke between colleagues, today, now that you're the lead of the team, it's different. And when you say a joke, the person is like, ha ha. And then later on at night, they're kind of like, what did my boss mean there? Does that, am I in trouble? Like, was he trying to tell me some message? And obviously that wasn't the case, but it just creeps in there. And that was a real learning moment for me of just being more thoughtful about the impact of what I'm saying to people that they're still my colleagues, but I happen to, you know, I'm the lead and I'm responsible for the outcomes of the team. It was a subtle but really significant shift. So that was a big change for me. What about your then you talk about a transition to actually understanding the responsibility or the opportunity, the ability to have more influence to support other people on their journey. I found that too. I noticed that too. And it became a really important part of the whole process for me, because people want support and they need support. And if you can work with a little bit of compassion and empathy and try to create an environment for these people where they can flourish, rather than, you know, sometimes I think a leader thinks that they have to have all the answers, when actually what you need to do, first of all, that's impossible.
Ask a lot of questions.
But what you actually need to do is ask a lot of questions and create the environment where the answers can emerge. Like, you don't have to have them all. But that's a really big difficulty, I think, for a lot of people who come from a traditional mindset about leadership or management and adapt to leadership. Does any of that resonate with you in any way? Is that part of your experience?
Yeah, because again, if you made a team lead about 6 weeks in and you still have no idea what the company does and how the code works, you just come into it from the position you know nothing. People around you know more. Like the people who are you leading, they would know way more about all these things. And it was a very interesting sort of way. I think it just helped a lot, because I think if I was promoted to be a lead after I was working with the company for a few years, it would have been a different context for me. I don't know if it was better or not this way, but it was definitely a very, very unique sort of perspective for me. So you know nothing, but suddenly you have all this context shift that you have to also stand up for your team and represent it and help the team members and, you know, all this bits that come with the position, while still learning yourself, while still floundering, because you don't know how things work, you don't know how to fix this, you don't know where to look for stuff, and it feels really interesting. It feels really interesting.
When did your learning stop as a leader?
Never.
Right. That's the thing.
It comes in waves, right? It's not necessarily something you do at work or work-related training or courses or counseling that you take, but just turns out so many things in life just contribute to your growth in that way, right? You just get ideas from everywhere. You get them from your therapist. You get them from the books you read. You get them from, like, random short videos you see online, and everything just starts contributing, because I think you're just... If you are in a position of, I know that I don't know everything, like anything is a learning opportunity at this point.
That's right. There's an outsized effect that also has on the people around you. You know, when you model that behavior as a lead, the people around you realize, oh, my lead wants to hear from me and actually appreciates hearing from me. And that's one thing. But what that also does is it helps you as an individual contributor while I'm doing my work. It helps me realize, it incentivizes me to notice things, because I get to share that back to my lead or my team, who actually gives a shit about what I'm noticing. And it helps. Like, it's a feedback loop, right? I mean, and that is such a interesting effect. So you, as a leader, I don't know everything, create space for other people to notice that they benefit from sharing information, and that actually encourages and multiplies that behavior. So there's this multiplying effect of just you being humble. And yeah. I don't know if people realize that.
It's fine to talk about it, and this is how I see it, but inevitably so many bad habits come out. Like, I have to have the answers, you know, I'm that bright kid in school that never got far in life. I have to have all the answers because if I don't have them, like, then what it is, right? And
right,
it's very hard. I recently got really funny feedback from my teammate, and I just really love it. He asks me to hop on a call when trying to solve a problem, and he shows me what's happening, and I'm like, okay, this is because of this and this. Let me check it. Let me change it and try again. And we try it and it doesn't work. And he brings up a valid point. I actually think it's a different thing. I'm like, oh yeah, great. I think that's it too. And so I switch and then, you know, we try again. And then he just starts laughing and says, you know what? Don't take it wrong, but you're like ChatGPT because you ask it something and it says, this is what it is. This is the answer. And you tell it, no, guy, you're wrong because of this and this. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. This is the right answer. And I just started laughing and I was like, you know what? You know what's the difference between me and ChatGPT? And he's like, no. I'm like, ChatGPT learns from their mistakes. Right? And This is really funny because when someone gives you that feedback, it was done in such a funny manner too that, you know, it just really sticks with you. So it's hard because you want to have the answers. You want to be the one that knows things because it also really feeds into my sort of
ego.
Mental. It's not even ego. It's I like to be helpful. I like to be
right.
Useful.
Oh, yeah.
I want to help people, and it really feeds into that. And not to have the answers, but being able to just sit down and work through it is like you need to change your habits. You need to let go of this, right? Or instances where there's a project, the deadline's looming, everyone's super busy. Okay, I'm going to take it myself. And this is where it's like very hard to start developing the correct sort of reasoning and judgment on when is it beneficial to actually just grab something out of the way of the team, and when is actually you have to talk through the team and delegate things and see who actually wants to do it and who's able to do it. It's like that's the adjustments that's still happening, basically.
I have a question based on what you just said, because I feel like I suffer from the same thing. I'm going to open up a little bit and say, I always feel like I need to be really helpful, whether I have the answer or not, and I'll run off and spend hours trying to do something for someone, even if I don't know how to do it. And I'll take that on. And then, based on what Clayton, you said earlier, when you joke around with your colleagues, but you're the lead, and then maybe they internalize it, I internalize everything. If somebody honks their horn at me, I'll be like an hour later being like, or even if I'm so arrogant in that thing, I'll think that a random horn honk was me. It had to be me. Like, it's almost narcissistic. What did I do? How did I wrong this person? And how can I make it a little bit better? So how do you get around that, like, knowing when to help and when not to help? When to step up? When to take the big swing?
I wish I had an answer, you know. This is something that is very, very hard for me. Just in general, because you go through high school, then you go through university. You know, I picked the computer science degree, and everything is quite rational. Most of these things are quite rational. There are rules, there are formulas. You get to know it. You start dealing with computers. It's like it does exactly what you tell it to do, right? There is no huge mysteries there. But then when you start dealing with people were always a huge mystery with me. Like, this is just, how do you formalize these things, right? Where do you even start? Why do I say the same thing to three different people and they'll react differently? And this was the same for me. Like, I knew myself. I know myself for, 30-something years now. And then suddenly I realized that I don't know anything because I just... I am a bunch of habits and impulses and traumas just rolled into a nice, like, little trench coat. It's all just cobbled together and you're trying to survive, right? And so untangling this, I think this is what the most helpful part of it is. Like, just try to untangle and see why do you react to the things the way you do. Just try to understand what hooks you up, right, in this situation. why does it have to be you? Like, it's not really the ego. It's not really that you are just the, you know, the middle of your world and everything revolves around you, which is, of course, is true for all of us. Like, we are at the middle of our own world. But just having that sort of understanding that you don't know everything about yourself just yet, and there are some things that you need to uncover, like, why do you react in this specific way to specific things? This been the most helpful. Like, what do I want to achieve by being helpful to this person? Is this the way I build relationships? Or is it just I have a looming task that I need to do and this is my way of procrastinating out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Or something else.
Yeah, I think in those moments, there's always a choice that we're making. So when a person, when we're presented with a problem by a person, it's we always have an opportunity to decide, what am I prioritizing? Am I prioritizing solution moving forward? Or am also should I also prioritize this other person's development? And we're always balancing that, right? Because you can't do everything all the time. But the more often a leader can realize, oh, if I just ask this person a follow-up question, lead with some curiosity, it'll help them better understand what they're actually doing. And it'll also understand, help me understand how they're thinking, which will pay off in the future. Because I better understand how this person thinks, what motivates them, what gets them excited, where they have confidence, where they have frailty. And the trick is always balancing progress and actions and outcomes with this personal and professional development. But the more we can realize that sometimes we should take a moment, and there's a lot of outsized benefits to doing that, that really helps the development of the other person. And it's obviously a great leadership skill to have. So there's just a benefit all along the path there.
I have a follow-up question real quick, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, because maybe it's too like close to home. You mentioned untangling the things, all the things put together, and you work on untangling them. What do you do to untangle those things? Like, what is advice you'd give to someone just based on your perspective, not as a licensed anything? What would you say is like a, this is how you go about untangling something. First step.
I think this is like, for me, it went like this. Therapy, psychedelics, and books, right? This is all it is. But just the mindset is the most interesting thing. You just have to change your mindset at some point. Because I think for me, it just started like unraveling the sweater. You can't really stop this. Like, you just pull and pull and pull, and it just keeps, you know, going. And as soon as you accept at least one fact about yourself that, you know, like, this is how things are, but they don't have to be this way, or if you just maybe accept the position of curiosity, like, why am I the way I am? I think that just starts building the awareness, and it's really hard to ignore things when you're aware of them, right? And even if you don't have the energy, like, I don't really know any people who just, let's say, started the therapy and just went through it, like, and just fixed everything about themselves or learned everything about themselves in one go. It happens over years. It happens in different environments with different people at a different pace, right? So you just have to be ready to start the journey and then just keep going at it.
So I shouldn't speed run therapy. Got that. No.
No, the also, real win is if you make the therapist cry.
Oh, great. I was going to say the other, just, and then we'll get back to it. I wanted to say the other day, Clayton read me a line from a book that he has near his computer. What is the Stoicism? I don't know what it is. The Daily Stoic. And I thought you read the thing. I was like, huh, I should actually read that. That would, anyway, so I think there's a lot of usefulness in conversations like this. So I just wanted to say before we keep going, I really appreciate it. I know we were going to talk about video gaming and then we did not talk about video games, but we can, or we can talk about whatever you guys want to talk about.
Thanks, Benny. I would actually like to talk about video games. So when you showed up, you had a video game, a gamer headset, which I always think is a good sign of a good person, because they spend some time playing video games, which is something that I absolutely love doing. What is it about? What types of video games do you like to play?
It's hard to say. I think most of the time, it's something to do with like being engaged in it mentally. Because when I was a kid, you know, it was the 90s, then 2000s, and I got access to a computer. And then back then, it was in Russia. They started publishing those really good games with Russian translations, so you could get a CD and play something. Or you could download it, or someone would copy it to you, you know. So we started just going through a lot of different games that we were able to get our hands on, I guess. And the things that stuck out to me the most were the quests. You know, the old school quests, where it's like, it's freaking pixel hunting. You don't know what's needed. You have to have some arcane knowledge sometimes. But that was engaging, because that's a story with the mystery and clues, and you just keep going through it. And I think this is largely the genre that I wish was more popular these days. People just don't make quests anymore. And then, I guess, later obsession was something unexpected, at least, but then also very expected, I guess, is sort of the automation games, like Factorio, you know? Which is interesting, because I never played Factorio itself, but I did play a lot of games in the same category. And this is something about just the optimization that tickles my brain the right way. You know, you just have to make it right. You just have to make it perfect. This is like a big shout out to Zachtronix games, the Opus Magnum, Shenzhen.io. Everything the studio made was just brilliant, and it just hooked me for 100 hours each, and I didn't know how to stop until I deleted the game from my computer. You just can't, because, you know, like, they hook you also in the right way, because you clear the level, you're like, okay, I can see how it works, and then you see the stats, and you're not in the top, and you're like, oh, I can be faster, I can be cheaper, and then you go forward with the game, and then you learn way better ways of doing things. So you come back and you start replaying the old level 7 times, because you just need to, you know, it's just that infinite loop of dopamine that just, you know, it pushes on all the buttons in my brain.
So you said Factorio is a game? So
yeah.
Can you describe this game a little bit? This genre of, actually describe the game a little bit. I'm familiar with it to an extent, but not that much. What do you do?
Without knowing any official knowledge of what it is actually called, so like layman's perspective on Factorio is, it's a game about building the optimization chains, basically. You start with raw materials and you need to build a rocket and fly off the planet. All the while, like, alien life keeps attacking you, sort of thing. And, you know, it becomes ridiculous, because at some point you just discover that you spent like the last 4 hours rebuilding your fuel supply lines, right? And it's so wonderful, because Factorio is also the type of the game that is quite complex in its own basic version. But people said, no, but wait, we want to have more. And so they introduced mods that actually make the chains twice as hard, because they follow the actual chemical processes and reactions of how you get to that component. So this is like a very, it's kind of like a Rubik's Cube, but in a game. You can spend hours fiddling with it. Like, this is just something that is purely mechanical at some point. It just becomes mechanical, but you're still engaged.
Yeah. I love games like, I used to play Age of Empires in the olden days, but there's a similarity there. Like, you have to take all these materials and make an outcome. In this case, it's a little town that attacks another town, but there's a complexity there, and the more and more times you use the same civilization, I also like Sid Meier's Civilization, I like Cities Skylines, like these sorts of, like SimCity back in the day, it's taking these same raw materials and trying to optimize, right? How could I attack that next village with only trebuchets and win them, and win that game? on hard, right? Like, you get to this level of kind of craziness.
You just optimize the hell out of it. Yeah,
exactly. Right. So you start out, you're a generalist, you've got a little bit of cavalry, you've got a little bit of, you know, artillery, you've got all these things, defenses. And then you get to the point where you're at the hardest level and you're like, I wonder if I could beat this next place with only villagers. And then that becomes your obsession. Just like, and
you come up with your own goals in the game, right? You do. Yeah.
And you're optimizing and optimizing and optimizing. Just like you said, you've spent 4 hours repurposing or reconfiguring a fuel supply or a fuel cell. It's the same thing. How do I, because I mean, you lose a lot when you're only trying to attack with villagers. Like, you lose most times until you don't. And then it's like, oh, I did it. I just wonder, what is it that is, what is it about these games that do you think that makes that enjoyable or useful or something? Why do we do this to ourselves? Because I love it.
I don't know. I think this is very interesting because you brought up a point that I don't have. I don't have that self-challenge mode.
Mm.
I'm a completionist. So if you give me a game and the game has achievements, this is my to-do list. Like, I will be stuck on it until I either give up or I can complete everything. This is where I don't really do my own challenges, because I think when I'm done with a game, I'm done with the game most of the time, unless it's just a comfort pastime.
No replay throughs?
No. There are some games that actually have a lot of sort of replayability, and those are mostly, like, I think at some point I just completely delved into the indie games, and they're like more atmospheric than...
Yeah.
Riveting gameplay, let's say.
Different vibe, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I found a lot of them so nice and calming and just... I keep returning back to them. There's like a game where you have to build... They just give you hex-shaped tiles. And on those tiles, you have a bit of forest, a bit of field, a bit of houses, a bit of river, a bit of something. They're all random. And the game gives you just little quests like make a village with 50 houses, make a forest with 100 trees... And you just keep slapping those tiles. So this one I can spend an hour on because it's just so peaceful. It's so nice. The music is relaxing. You just sit there. And I think those are like the different games hook you in different ways, right?
Yeah. There's so many different genres. I mean, Rhonda likes to play comfort games. Are you familiar with? Yeah, she loves that genre of comfort games. She just loves it. What are you doing? I'm mowing the lawn. Oh, okay. Neat. I'm planting a garden. I'm, you know,
power washing simulator.
Right. It is so bonkers how these things can absorb our...
House Flipper is a relaxing game. Well, not really.
I haven't seen that one. I'm pretty limited, actually. I'm a PS5 guy, so I'm pretty limited on my games. So since I've been into PS5, it's a lot of sports and racing and stuff, but the quest games like Red Dead Redemption and these long, that's not a quest game, but these long narrative adventure games. Yeah, it's. But you know what I think people don't realize that don't play video games is just the production quality, the narrative value. Rhonda and I played Red Dead Redemption 2 together. So I'm really good at controllers. She's really good at understanding the game and where we might go and what we might do. So we worked together on it. We played for, you know, hundreds of hours. And then at the end, when Arthur Morgan dies, we both
spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't played this 6-year-old game yet, you're out of luck. But when he dies, it's like, it's really sad. And the production, it's like, and when I say that to people, they're like, what are you talking about? You cried. No, like, imagine being in a movie for 200 hours.
That is interactive.
But you're in the movie. And you influenced how the whole movie worked. That is the type of engagement that you get. And then the crying is just so natural at the end. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh. And there's also a little bit of sorrow because, wow, this game's over. That's kind of sad, too.
I have a friend who replays the games for that reason. He really likes Witcher 3. And he really likes narrative style games. So he just replays Witcher 3, I think, once a year at this point. He just loves the story. And then we were talking yesterday and he said, oh, yeah, I replayed Last of Us again. I cried again. I'm like, well, I mean, that's all it is, right? Yeah.
You. But it adds so much value, I think. Video games add so much value to our lives. But anyway, if you know, you know, I guess. It's one of those things.
I feel like the spaceship game that you mentioned would be a great birthday present that Clayton and I could get John Edmonds this year. I was going to say, it's really just funny, like, all the different genres of games and how everything has evolved. I used to be on a team with James Ingold, and I remember he, for a while, was playing a truck driving simulator. So he would come into work and tell me how he would do a long haul.
And I actually bought James's wheel from him, and it's essentially real time. So when you drive from one city to the next, it takes an hour. It takes 2 hours. And you have to back up the truck. You have to load up you have to get your load on the trailer. You have to drop it off at a convenience store and get into this really crazy parking. Like, it's so wild how mundane yet fully engrossing it is. Like, you're just zoned
in. I really
want
to know if there is like a real truck driver who plays this game after work just to relax.
Relax.
I would imagine not, but maybe, like, maybe someone so passionate. I know a lot of race car drivers now, like, in the sim world.
Verstappen.
And even, like, younger in the drifting world, there's people that are using sims, and they're saying the correlation between driving on a sim to getting behind the wheel of an actual car is becoming so, like, minuscule.
Yeah, the simulations
that you can
are
make
really
that
great now. Yeah. Darcy is playing, actually. Darcy has a great sim rig for playing Formula One games.
Does he? I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
he was trying to get me to buy a $300 controller, so I'm not surprised that he's got the system.
Yeah.
He lives close to me, actually.
Yeah, go check it out. It's
I'm
really
go
great.
Over there after work.
Recently, he invited some folks from Regina Department of Gova, basically, just to go hang out at his place. And they were so excited about it. And then I asked them, how did it go? And they're like, oh, it's so much harder than we imagined.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like, it's quite unforgiving.
It's very realistic.
It's very realistic, yeah. You can't just like smash some buttons and win. No, no.
It's not an
arcade
game.
You have to know how to drive.
For people who don't, I have a racing simulator too, and not a good rig, but I have the wheel and the foot pedals and stuff. And in order to even play that game quite well, you almost have to be meditating to play it. If you think about, oh, I wonder if my home insurance went through, you crashed. Like as soon as other thoughts enter your mind, you're done. Like, your race is over. And I don't think really people realize that. The level of engagement that it requires from you, these sim games. Anyway, that's great. I just want to go off on this tangent about sim racing, but I won't. Because I'm thinking about all the setup, all of the, like, it's incredible. The parts you can buy for these cars, the way you can tune them. But as a larger narrative arc, in terms of an interesting part of a podcast, the fidelity in these games, the real world, the way they recreate the real world for you in these games is part of what's so engrossing. Like you said, you know, you spend all this time and you're doing all this, you're talking about a fuel cell and how you can all spend hours doing this. It's just engrossing. It's like reading a book or something. Like, it's actually doing something good for your brain too, I think.
So this is interesting. I actually don't play a lot of hyper-realistic games. I generally actually stay away from all the big releases. I don't really care for, like, travel alone in the world and shoot everything that moves kind of games. occasionally I would play something of the sort, but probably years after the release when it's like on sale for $15.
I'm a pre-orderer. I'm pre-ordered, pre-downloaded, and I'm waiting for it to go. But I also did admit I'm a PS5 guy, and you did say you're an indie person.
I'm a PC player. So, I'm a PC player. I never really owned a PlayStation or anything. The closest I got was, I think I have a 3DS somewhere still kicking around. And
3DS?
I have Nintendo. Small handheld.
Oh, I know.
Handheld, right? And then basically aside from a couple of handhelds, I didn't really have anything. So my 300 plus game collection on Steam is all I have to show. That's, you know, and to that point, collecting games and playing games are two different distinct hobbies, and I will down that hill. But yeah, it's an interesting part about games for me is that it doesn't have to be hyper realistic to really hook you in. A few years back, I remember my friends started hyping me up. I have a friend group that are really excited about a lot of new game releases, and I just see them cycle through a game a month that they play all together and then abandon because something new came out and they just jump on the new thing. And then I see them play a game called Valheim and they're like, join us, it's so cool, it's pre-release, but they already have so much content. And I was like, skeptical. Guys, it's all pixelated, just look at this, they didn't even bother doing any shaders, it's just all pixelated and whatnot, and so simplistic and weird. I'm just a Viking in this weird, almost 2D world, the way it's built. And then I started playing. Like, 3 hours into the game, the nature is beautiful, the trees are amazing, the water is realistic, you're so into it, your brain just makes up all the difference. And this is actually very great. So some games are made in such a great way that they don't need to rely a lot of hyperrealism or graphics to hook you in and make you believe this is the best game ever. Like, this is what we do ourselves, and I think this is a very cool part of game development. You can just grab an idea that will play itself. You don't need to support or supply it with a lot of resources and design and whatnot.
It reminds me of those memes. It's like when I would have been 12 and you're playing Nintendo 64 or like PlayStation 2 and you're like, could graphics get any better than this? And it's just like
a bunch of pixels, yeah.
A bunch of pixels on a like an maybe a mildly realistic face slapped onto something. I was gonna ask, do you have like your top three video games of all time? Like for me, I love GoldenEye for Nintendo 64, but that just tells you who I am as a person.
Wow, it's robotic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very social thing. That was when you know, Nintendo had four controllers. You could all sit in a room together with your friends, eat pizza at a slumber party, stay up too late, and play that.
I think Heroes of Might and Magic 3 might be one of my top three. It just has so much nostalgic value. I grew up playing this game, and this is something that every few years, I remember I have it, and I set up Hamachi, and I poke someone to play with me, and we just play for like a few nights. It's something that is just, I think this is how people end up with like favorites. This is just such a big childhood thing. It's just connected to the memories of the period. You just hooked to this whole idea of reliving that time. And like for pure nostalgic value, yeah, Heroes of Might and Magic 3, amazing game. Dungeon Keeper 2, amazing game. Bunch of pixels, executed so well. I think I remember this game in such detail, and then I look at it, it's a bunch of pixels. I'm like, how did my brain remember this in such vivid detail? It just gets to you.
That's a good question. We must fill in the blanks so much in our heads. Once you get into it, you just kind of you lose the pixelation, and you're just playing this game. You know, like Wolfenstein or whatever. Yeah.
I was just going to say, think of like what Mario actually looked like in Nintendo. Like you were playing as this Italian plumber chasing a dinosaur to free a princess, and it looked nothing like a person, but they showed you a picture of him once and you're like, that's it. And same with Link. You're like, oh yeah, of course he's in, you know, but you make that connection and then it just carries on forever. And yeah, it's a wild thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I do also love the connection to community. Like, it really creates community. Like you said, you remember this game and you poke somebody and it's like a nostalgia, little time travel for you. You get transported back to this different time in your life and you're playing with friends, and it's become such an aspect of community for people too, which I really love.
Yeah. And I think the biggest mystery for me, you know, sometimes you meet people who say, I don't do something. And you might hear, I don't read books. And I was like, fine. I also went through a period where I read no books. I can understand how you get into that mind space. You just have other sources of information, I guess, around you. So many, you don't really want to read anything. But then you start getting into details. There are some people who say, I never read fiction books. And I'm like, why? And then you see people who say, I never play games. And I think for me, this is such a big mystery because I don't really understand the reasons. Like, I don't understand why you would just cut yourself off of that huge slice of art, I guess, in a way. Entertainment industry, you know, something that's quite big and something that's so diverse, you can literally find anything. I'm always fascinated by people who say, no, I don't play any games. I never played any computer games. And I was like, not a single game of solitaire? Really?
Right.
Not a single Candy Crush match?
Minesweeper? Come on. Minesweeper?
Yeah.
I think that's a thing that will slowly shift. I think more and more, I'll give you an analogy. There is a generation of people that were like, I've never seen Star Wars. I've never watched Star Wars. And it's a badge of honor. They're like, that is for nerds. And now, as time has progressed, it becomes almost like the weirder thing is if you've never seen Star Wars, right? So this badge of honor of someone being like, haha, you know, I was alive when it came out and I thought that was for nerds and I was busy playing sports and I didn't do that. But now it's such a cultural touchstone for a lot of things. So I think video games will do that. Like, it was very early on was perceived as one thing for one type of person, but it just it grew and grew. And now it'll be one of those things where it's probably more like, oh, if you don't do it, it might actually be the stranger thing is to abstain.
It always makes me wonder. So we have a generation of our parents and grandparents that we see growing old, and we see how these people spend their free time. And it's, you know, so like you either just sit at home and watch TV if you're alone, if you don't really have much people around you, right? Or you sit and, I don't know, gossip on the bench next to your house, or you go for a walk in the park and whatnot. Maybe read a book. Maybe listen to music, because that was their pastime, I guess. And now, like, when we will be old, what it's going to be? Like, will we feel less lonely because we have social online games that we're so used to playing? And you can just connect and talk to anyone? I don't know if you've ever seen, there is a fascinating Twitch streamer, Tactical Grandma. She plays Call of Duty. She's 60. She plays Call of Duty, and she shit talks like no tomorrow. It's fascinating. And she's so proud of who she is, and she's like, oh yeah, I've been playing this since it came out. I played through the whole series when all the kids try to shit talk her and say, go to the kitchen, make a sandwich. And she's living the life. She's so popular, she's making money off her streams, you know. And this is what we'll be looking at, because you keep your entertainment the same you had it, basically, right? If you're used to playing games, you will be playing games until you can't.
Yeah. I feel like it's like antiques a little bit. I always wonder, I don't know if this fits in or not, but I'm going to tell you because you made me think of it. And it's funny to me, the generational thing with antiques, which is like my father-in-law collected antiques. And my parents have things in their basement that are antiques. And eventually one day, through the course of nature, they will inherit them. But it's, what do you do with these things? Like, they don't mean this. An old-timey telephone with the windy wheel, you know, doesn't mean the same thing to me that it means to my parents. And I think that antiques are going to shift, where it's like, you'll probably have people, it's the nostalgia of chasing, oh, I want the old Nintendo, or I want the old Sega Genesis. And what happens to those old things? So I guess in the same way, it's like, yeah, our interests, well, you'll probably just have a bunch of old people sitting around chasing down old video game systems or something.
Right now, there is a big revival on having physical copies of the game because of all the streaming service problems and subscriptions that you lose access to immediately as when you stop playing. So we're all praying to God that Steam stays the way it is forever. Even though
I've been buying. I've been buying media for sure.
Yeah, it's the least predatory of all the systems, and it's still not a physical copy technically. But yeah.
Or at all.
Well, no, because they there's been a case recently where they removed the game from Steam that people paid for because they shut down the service and they just removed the game. So you paid for something, but it's no longer there because that's it.
There is a whole movement around physical
owning versus
media.
Owning renting, things. Yeah.
Like I've been buying vinyl for a few years, but now I started buying some CDs, and I definitely started buying my PS5 games again. I used to just download them for a few years because, well, what could be better? Well, owning something actually turns out to be better. So I started doing that, and it's a movement. It's a movement. I'm not sure what I'm reacting to in the world, but something feels weird, and I'm buying stuff. So,
well,
anyway,
the same thing's happening with movies because it's like you stream, and then you have all these streaming services. But then, what happens if you want to watch a movie and you can't find that movie on the streaming service? But then again, I'm going to go back to Star Wars because clearly I like Star Wars. There is an original version of Star Wars from the 70s and the 80s that you can no longer watch because George Lucas decided the updated version that he did with all the added stuff in it is now the version that everyone gets. But it doesn't make as much sense as the original one that he made. The only people that can access it
have
are the ones that have.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's maybe one of the bigger mistakes I did was when I moved here to Vancouver, I left all of my DVDs in Regina at my parents' place. And it's like, oh man, I have all this stuff. And now sometimes to watch something. Yeah, I don't. And now we go to watch something and it's like, oh, it's not there and you can't have it. And you have to either rent it or watch this version of it that you don't want.
Yeah, I'm not, like, even books disappearing from your Kindle, like books being edited after. It's just these little weird things. When you have digital copies, it's not really your copy in a way, and it can be edited and changed and deleted. And
so is this like a way to fight the history revisionism?
Yeah, of course. You know, that's kind of where it aims at. Yeah, partially. But that's a whole another topic for a whole different next time podcast. That does seem like a great place to stop, though, just because we've had a couple of nice conversations around leadership and the work experience and then gaming and the effect it has on people. And then this was a really nice, well-rounded conversation. I really can't thank you enough for joining us today, Sasha.
Wait, before you go. Clayton's got 5 questions for you.
5 questions.
They're easy. 5 questions. They're easy peasy.
All right, here we go, buddy. 5 questions, just binary yes or no's, or one or the others. Simple questions. So do you prefer summer or winter?
Summer.
Do you prefer a book or a movie?
A book.
Do you prefer the mountains or a beach?
Both.
There you go. How about making plans or winging it? What's your vacation like?
Making plans before winging it on the spot.
I see. You got backup. We're just going to do whatever the hell we want, but I also have a plan in case that doesn't work. All right. That makes sense. Do you drink coffee or tea?
Both.
Sweet. Well, that's that. Sasha, just an absolute treat to have you here. I hope you enjoyed yourself. Benny and I
Thank
had
so
a great
much.
Time.
Awesome. I did. I'll let Clayton speak for me. I did have a lot of fun. It was great. Thanks for hanging out.
Right on.
Thank you so much, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're back. You know, that was a real treat. I particularly enjoyed the part where I tried to get free trickle-down therapy from Sasha. You know, I know our benefits cover it, but that's not what I'm about. Just try to do it through podcasts so everyone can hear me.
There was a lot of nice stuff in there. Some of the things that I really enjoyed about it is just how the experience that Sasha had really lined up with what she was expecting. And then the effect of that on her as a person. The fact that she doesn't have to mask herself here. She can just be her. authentic self. She feels supported here because she is supported here. She's surrounded by humans who care about the experience that she's having and want her to succeed, and they support her to do that. And I just loved how that narrative emerged from her in this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's great that we can have conversations like that. But then on the other side, we can just talk about video games, which is what the tail end of this podcast is that, hey, you can have the conversation where someone asks you for life advice, but then also you could just talk about video games and what they mean to you. And I think there's still an added benefit to having conversations like that with your coworkers. It builds bridges. And I really liked that we were able to do that. And I liked that she had all the equipment from gaming because it makes doing a podcast easier. So that was great. Speaking of doing a podcast, we're doing it still. And, you know, I believe we're, what are we trying to do? What's our goal?
1,000.
1,000.
We're so trying to get to 1,000.
We're still unsure of what, but let me tell you, this helped move the dial.
1,000 something. We moved towards 1,000 something.
So big shout out to Sasha for helping move the dial on that. And yeah, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, by all means, please reach out to us. You can always leave a review of the podcast if you haven't, and we'll read that and write it in our dream journal. But otherwise, until then, we won't take up any more of your time. Until next time, keep reaching for the stars.
Yes, don't not do that.
It's o facto, that's a rapo.
Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.